Headlines: the Ukrainian president pledges to defeat all threats on the first anniversary of his country's war with Russia. Iran says its defense and military ties with Russia are based on mutual interests and not aimed at third parties. Palestinians hold massive street rallies across the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip in protest at Israel's deadly raid on Nablus. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Now, February 24th marks the 1 year since the ongoing war broke out in Ukraine. Russia launched what it called a special military operation to protect its borders in the face of security threats posed by the West. Moscow says it will go ahead with its operations as long as the threats exist. Ukraine, at the same time, has pledged to continue defending itself. We discuss this in our news review program. Let's take a listen. Welcome to another edition of the news review. In this edition, Friday, today, marks the first anniversary of the Russia-Ukraine war, the largest in Europe since World War II. 1 year on, there seems to be no end in sight to the conflict, with both sides being determined to defend themselves against what they see as threats. Russia has been focusing its battles on eastern Ukraine. It has annexed four eastern regions through referenda after seizing them on the battlefield. As the war has raged on, Kiev has launched counteroffensives to take back the territories that it has lost. It has been successful to retake some areas thanks to the military support from the West. Russia now controls around one-fifth of Ukrainian territory. The war has claimed the lives of tens of thousands of people on either side. Millions of Ukrainians have been displaced too. Russia has called the war a special military operation aimed at demilitarizing and denazifying Ukraine. Moscow has said that it aims to protect its security, threatened by the Western military alliance's eastward expansion. To discuss that further, we're joined by Mr. Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator from Moscow. Also, we have with us Greg Simons, researcher from the Institute for Russia and Eurasian Studies, joining us from Sweden. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Let's begin with our guest from Moscow, Mr. Weir. It has been 1 year exactly today since Russia started its military operation. How close do you see Russia in achieving its objectives?
It is so hard to answer that question. We are... at some kind of turning point. It is definitely a changed situation, but I'm afraid it's changed in the direction of becoming far more serious, far more bloody and destructive. Both sides, I think, are poised for major battlefield action. The one bright side, I think, is that the intervention of the Chinese for the first time, in a major way on the diplomatic front, even though the peace plan that they outlined will not be acceptable to either side just now, it suggests that China, which will have credibility in Moscow, is ready to weigh in on the need for a peace settlement to this, because of course this war has been already horrifically destructive. I mean, it has pretty much decimated Ukraine, and it's been costly to Russia, incredibly costly, and it also, in terms of the global system, it's ripping apart whatever kind of global stability we had, and it's doing damage to the political culture in Russia. It's war has dire effects on societies, and God knows what it's doing to Ukraine. But I wonder, I fear that Ukraine may not emerge as a viable state from this war. So all in all, it is not a happy anniversary, and I think we have lots to be anxious about in the months to come.
You are absolutely right, and a good sign of that is a resolution that was passed yesterday by the United Nations. So I would like to bring in our guest from Sweden regarding this resolution demanding Russia to cease its attacks on Ukraine. And how likely do you see Russia abiding by that resolution?
I don't see them really abiding by it, because in terms of the military advantage, this is in Russia's favor at the moment. I mean, they haven't enacted their offensive. It's coming. So there is no reason for them to do that, logically. And especially, they understand that what the West has been doing this last year has been to fan it. I mean, you even have Colonel Black, who's a senator in the US, who's saying that this has been going on for years. So even before the Ukraine war, and I mean, as Fred said, I mean, this is heading towards somewhere much more dangerous. And I mean, this Colonel Black suggested that it's even heading towards a hot war, not only between Ukraine and Russia, where the West is using Ukraine to fight to the last Ukrainian against Russia, but a more wide war.
Thank you very much, Greg Simons, a researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, joining us live from Sweden, and also Mr. Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator from Moscow. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. On Iran, this says its military and defense ties with Russia are based on mutual interests and not aimed at third countries. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani made the comment in an interview with Russia's Sputnik news agency. He said that Tehran and Moscow are boosting their relations based on the political will of their top leaders. The Iranian official also reiterated his country's call for a political solution to the Ukraine war. He said Tehran has been pushing for that since the beginning of the conflict in February last year. Kanani also said that the countries which send tens of billions of dollars in military aid to one side of the war do not want the conflict to end. He was referring to Western states' military support for Ukraine. And Iraq's holy city of Karbala is hosting thousands of Muslims who are celebrating the birthday anniversary of the third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein. Karbala hosts the holy shrine of Imam Hussein, who is also the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. People have converged on the city from across Iraq to mark Imam Hussein's birth anniversary. Muslims from other countries, including Iran, also visit the country for this occasion. There, they attend Imam Hussein's holy shrine as part of the celebrations. Muslims regard Imam Hussein as a symbol of freedom and resistance because of his battles against the tyrant of his time, Yazid. Thousands of Palestinians have poured into the streets across the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip in protest at Israel's deadly raid on Nablus. The rallies came following an earlier call by the Palestinian resistance group Lion's Den. It urged Palestinians to take to the streets to show to the world that the resistance is ready to give a rapid response to any Israeli aggression. Ismail Haniyeh, who heads the political bureau of Hamas resistance movement, issued a message lauding the massive street rallies. He said, "The people of Palestine and the resistance front will not allow anybody to stop the ongoing anti-Israeli uprising across the West Bank. Nearly a dozen Palestinians were killed and more than 100 injured in the Israeli forces Wednesday raid on the city of Nablus. A 22-year-old Palestinian youth identified as Mohammed Jawabra also died early on Friday. He succumbed to injuries that he suffered earlier on Thursday during an Israeli attack on a refugee camp in the city of Al-Khalil.
Tensions are flaring up again across the Palestinian territories as the Israeli regime has intensified its bloody crackdown there. After a day of mayhem and bloodshed in the West Bank by the regime's forces, Israeli warplanes rained down missiles on the besieged Gaza Strip, prompting Palestinians to hit back with rockets. Wednesday's Israeli raid on West Bank was the deadliest in about two decades. Nearly a dozen people were killed and scores more were injured after the regime's forces, backed by armored vehicles, surrounded the city of Nablus, opened fire on the people, including teenagers and elderly. Thousands of Palestinians gathered to mourn the death of their loved ones. Nablus and the nearby city of Jenin have repeatedly come under Israeli attacks over the last couple of months. Palestinians find themselves helpless in front of the occupying regime and its ruthless agenda.
What is happening on the ground is organized state terrorism, which the Israeli occupation government is solely responsible for. The international silence regarding these crimes is an encouragement for the occupation.
Many believe that the inaction of the UN and other international bodies, as well as unwavering support of certain governments for Israel, emboldens the regime to go ahead with its crimes against Palestinians.
The international community supports Israel. There are governments like the United States and the United Arab Emirates that are supporting and funding the Israeli occupation to do the horrific things that they are doing to our people. It is rather sick. We consider them partners in crime, basically. Now, why do they do it? They do it very simply because there's a very strong Zionist lobby around the world that promises them various things, especially keeping their regimes in power.
In doing Israeli crimes over the past several decades, Palestinians have realized that they cannot expect more than condemnation of Israel from the international community.
The right response to Israel is the activation of resistance across the occupied territories and retaliatory attacks against the regime's forces and settlers.
The Israeli regime has piled up pressure on Palestinians with deadly crackdown, illegal detention, and demolition of their homes. Years of crippling siege of the Gaza Strip is yet another example how the regime has turned the Palestinian territory into an open prison. The people in Gaza and the West Bank have been living in fear and agony as they lose their loved ones almost on a daily basis. But Israel's Western and regional backers keep watching the regime's bloodshed silently.
Our correspondent, Tashraf Shannon, earlier joined us from Gaza to tell us more about the anti-Israeli rallies there.
What happened last night with the tens of thousands of people coming out to protest shows some sort of like referendum or consensus among Palestinians that they are supporting the resistance. The reason for the rallies is the call made by the leadership of the Lion's Den in the occupied West Bank, who called on all Palestinians everywhere to take to the street at midnight to express their support. What Palestinians are trying to say here, Gisu, is that Palestinian blood is the same blood everywhere Palestinians are living, whether it's the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, Palestinian areas that were occupied in 1948, or Gaza. It shows unity among Palestinians.
North Korea has said that it has test-fired four strategic cruise missiles towards the sea off the east coast of the Korean Peninsula. The North says that the launch aims to demonstrate the country's deadly nuclear counterattack capabilities against what it calls hostile forces. Pyongyang says the four cruise missiles hit a preset target after traveling 2,000 kilometers. The launch follows a tabletop exercise at the Pentagon by the U.S. and South Korea. The two said the exercise focused on responses to the nuclear attack by North Korea. Washington and Seoul have also stepped up military drills in the region over the past several months. Pyongyang is strongly of the opinion that these ramped-up drills are a declaration of war.
The U.S. wasted no time scrambling jets in response to North Korea's recent long-range missile launch, deploying strategic assets capable of carrying nuclear bombs with South Korean fighter aircraft. At the United Nations, the U.S. placed responsibility for the tension on North Korea.
We echo the Council's consistent demand that the DPRK comply with its obligations under numerous UN Security Council resolutions, abandon its weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile program in a complete, verifiable, and irreversible manner, and engage constructively in diplomacy.
North Korea has steadily developed a nuclear deterrent in the face of expanding U.S. militarization of South Korea. China calls for dialogue.
On the Korean Peninsula issue, we adhere to pursuing in parallel the establishment of a peace mechanism and the denuclearization process of the peninsula, and address the legitimate concerns of all parties in a balanced manner, and maintain peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. has agreed to frequently deploy nuclear-capable weapons to the region at South Korea's request. The U.S. and South Korea seem to have agreed to raise the tension on the Korean Peninsula in an attempt to somehow force North Korea into negotiations on arms control or denuclearization. This reverses the policy of the previous South Korean government that brought about a reduction in tension through engagement and dialogue. Local analysts warn of potential conflict.
When North Korea does something, the South Korea-U.S. alliance reacts. And if the South Korea-U.S. alliance does something, North Korea reacts. And this vicious cycle continues. The stronger the deployment of U.S. strategic assets, the more fragile the peace on the Korean Peninsula, and the faster the arms race. And this risks creating a security dilemma, and more seriously, a war crisis.
More regional tension seems inevitable as South Korea seeks to celebrate the 70th anniversary of its alliance with the U.S. with ever larger war games. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
While Ukraine is devastated by war and Europe is caught in an economic crisis, the United States is making a lot of profit from selling weapons to Ukraine. However, the majority of the American people are against the financial and military support of the Biden administration for Kiev. We've taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. English website of Al Mayadeen television network has covered this story and tells us more. Thousands of anti-war demonstrators took to the streets of Washington on Sunday, 19th of February, against the U.S. government's warmongering policies, urging the Biden administration to stop supplying arms to Ukraine and to disband the NATO military alliance. The biggest demonstration was held at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., a symbolically significant venue for American political activists as people participated in the Rage Against the War Machine national rally. The protesters at the rally, who held anti-war placards, called for peace talks between Russia and Ukraine and an end to U.S. funding of military aid to Kiev. They also called for diverting the Pentagon budget to fund numerous domestic needs. The anti-war protesters also demanded the dissolution of the NATO military alliance, blaming NATO for horrors of war in much of the world. Nick Branagh of the People's Party and Angela McArdle of the Libertarian Party, who moderated the national rally, described the event as an opportunity by the organizers and the speakers from across the political spectrum of the United States to bring together the left and the right and end the war in Ukraine. Pacifist journalist and author Chris Hedges delivered one of the keynote speeches at the event. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, who was a foreign correspondent for 15 years for the New York Times, where he served as West Asia Bureau Chief and Balkan Bureau Chief for the New York Times, set the platform for the notable left-right speakers who would follow up in the national gathering. Veteran U.S. Congressman and former presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, Ron Paul, was one of the speakers who spoke at the rally, stating that a simple way to stop the war was to end the Fed and to not send people to war unless they vote for it. Former U.S. Congresswoman and presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard, who spoke, reminding the crowd of what caused her to run in 2020 and how there was no other candidate willing to talk about the dangers where this new Cold War and nuclear arms race would lead. Former Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein was another speaker at the rally. Jill Stein called for slashing the Pentagon's enormous budget, arguing in her speech that even the $100 billion we are spending to support the war in Ukraine could help the nation solve a wide range of domestic issues. Jill Stein said, "This murderous military spending consumes resources desperately needed here at home by 70,000 people who die each year for lack of health insurance. For 500,000 homeless people on any given night out in the streets of America, for 33 million mired in student debt, 100 million in medical debt, and 22 million impoverished children, and so on and so forth." Former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who fought for the Democratic nomination in 2004 and 2008, cited a bombshell report by Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh to demand accountability from the U.S. government. Dennis Kucinich said, "In blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline, this government has used illegal and unconstitutional means to destroy the energy resources needed to protect millions of people in Europe during winter, and then to profit from its illegal actions by selling energy to Europe at a 4 to 6 times markup." Dennis Kucinich pointed out that the White House's greatest talent is to craft misinformation and disinformation to subvert the media and misuse it as an instrument to incite fear and hatred among our people, exiting partisan divisions at home through cross-politics and stirring ancient hatred abroad through lies, deceit, false flag operations and provocations which profane the very essence of democracy. At one point, comedian and political commentator Jimmy Dore went on stage. Jimmy Dore asked the crowd why the United States was sending funds to aid the pro-Nazi Kiev government when people in the United States itself are in dire economic straits and needed money to purchase eggs. or other basic items for their survival. Similar demonstrations were also held in Bath and Westbrook, Maine, to protest the billions of dollars the United States is spending to arm Ukraine. Peace groups and other organizations of the rallies also called for dismantling of the NATO alliance and to slash America's military budget. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered this issue and tells us more. Hundreds of protesters on Sunday afternoon, 19th of February, slammed America's role of war machine in overseas wars at a rally before the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Organizers said the anti-war rally was planned to protest against massive money funneling into Ukraine, as well as America's role in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. A statement said billions of taxpayer dollars are being torched at the altar of U.S. hegemony, the military-industrial complex, and a corrupt Congress. Jimmy Dore, American political commentator and media personality, spoke at Sunday's rally, echoing that America is corrupt. Jimmy Dore said, "Do you know we could end this war today through diplomacy, but our politicians want to enrich weapons manufacturers so they keep donating to them." Kat McGuire, a protester from New York City, told China's Xinhua news agency, "The overarching goal of this rally is to stop the war in Ukraine." Kat McGuire said, "People have to wake up. There's massive warmongering propaganda, and unfortunately, too many people have bought into it." Other speakers and protesters also lashed out at America's military-industrial complex, a powerful interest group made up of the military, private defense contractors, and politicians. The protesters then marched to the White House after the rally, chanting slogans like "No to NATO, No to War." Eric Reeves, a protester from Texas, said the military-industrial complex, which has a huge influence on Washington's decision makers, is way out of control. He complained the U.S. government is not doing the will of the American people and making decisions without consulting us. U.S. President Joe Biden made an unannounced visit to Kiev on Monday, 20th of February, and pledged a military aid package worth $500 million, almost a year into the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The United States, by far the largest supplier of military assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the war, also announced an additional $500 million aid package, which will include more military equipment and more weapons, like the anti-tank Javelin missiles, for Kiev. During his visit, President Biden vowed that Washington would stand with Ukraine as long as it takes.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the 9th divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. This great Imam was one of the founders of the jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. He was one of the founders of the very jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt that represented creation, originality, and the progress of intellect. Scholars have reported from Imam al-Jawad a wonderful variety of wisdom and literature regarding noble deeds and conducts that are among the most precious maxims dealing with different educational and moral and ethical issues.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. In a very beautiful conversation, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam talks to one of his companions, and he talks to the companions about a certain slip and a certain error or mistake which is not forgiven. Now, it's very interesting, but when we keep the life of the divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad, into context and we take into consideration the kind of environment that he was living in, of course we find that it was an environment that was full of moral and ethical corruption and decadence. Now, in this kind of an environment, of course, which began from the Caliph Osman's time through the Umayyad Caliphate, and of course it reached to the point of the Abbasid Caliphate, where this moral and ethical decadence was pretty much reaching its peak, if it hadn't already reached its peak. And so, of course, carnal desires and lusts and base desires and greed and jealousy and other negative immorality and bad virtues, if it can be said in that manner, had become so prevalent in society that Islam was no longer that pure Muhammadan Islam which had been brought by the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Here, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says to his companion that the rider of lusts, their slip is not forgiven. And so, as we had said in the beginning of the program, of course, this slip and this error and this mistake, which is not forgiven from the one who is the rider of lusts. And so here, you know, we might wonder, what does this exactly mean, the rider of lust? Well, here it means one who submits to their carnal desires, their base desires, their lowly desires, and one who submits to their various kind of lusts. And of course, when you submit to these carnal desires and these base low desires, then of course you become a captive to them. In another set of traditions, we find that these base desires are also comparable to the materialistic aspect of the world. And when speaking about the materialistic aspect of the world, the infallibles and the immaculate imams, peace and blessings upon them all, have taught us how they are either like a mirage,
something which is seen but is not real and can never be achieved. And two, it's been given the similitude of salt water, where the more you drink, the thirstier you get, until you eventually either go mad or you die. And here, one who becomes captive to their base desires, one who submits and obeys their base desires, their slip and their error and their mistake will surely happen, but it will also not be forgiven or excused. Why? Well, you made an error or you made a slip because of the fact that originally you are doing something which is wrong. Originally, you are submitting to base desires. You are making yourself a captive and obedient to base desires. And so you shouldn't expect anything other than making a slip or making errors or making mistakes. And so here it is, of course, of utmost importance that we control our base desires, that we rise above our base desires. And for example, there are certain desires which have to be kept in check and kept in balance. They have to be kept in harmony. So whether it is our physical desires, we solve that through marriage. But even then, these physical desires should be reined in, they should be controlled, they should be kept in balance. Just like all of our other base desires, we should be the ones who are controlling them, commanding them, and using these desires. For example, whether it is the desire to eat food, the desire to drink something, you know, water or juice, or the desire for physical pleasure. All of these things have to be controlled. They have to be done in a halal way, a permissible way, and must be done in a way which it brings us closeness to Allah and it does not take us away from Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Jawad, alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old. Basically, look at the special wisdom that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to our ninth imam. What is zinat? Beauty. We even had a marriage. You know, we hear many times, Inna Allah jamilun yuhibbul jamal. Allah is beautiful and He loves beauty. And we hear it mostly in the context of marriage ceremonies. But we do realize that, you know, when we talk about the jamal of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that He is jameel and He likes jamal, it's not really about physical beauty. Especially in the marriage ceremony and in the context of marriage, you know, the beauty is actually in the eyes of the beholder. For every groom, the wife, the bride is the Zulaikha, and for her, that's her Yusuf. You know, so, but we had to realize that when we talk about zinat and beauty and jamal, from the Islamic perspective, when you look at the Quran and the ahadith of the Masumeen, this concept transcends, you know, physical realm. It covers our moral and ethical dimension also, and it even reaches to the level of spirituality. If you look at the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually talks about different dimensions of zenith when He talks about the earth itself. But let us go to the hadith of the Imam, where Imam talks about a zenith in a very different level. He's talking about the zenith in the character of a human being. Zenith in the akhlaq of a human being. There are about 12 to 15 issues that he talks about it. And he says, in all this situation that you might find yourself, you have to look for the element in that situation which can be zenith for you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir, /en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The Republican-led U.S. House of Representatives adopted a package of internal rules that give right-wing hardliners more leverage over the chamber's newly elected Republican Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CBS News has covered the story and tells us more. The House of Representatives on Monday, 9th of January, narrowly passed a package of rules governing its operations for the 118th Congress and laying out the Republican majority's priorities, fresh off a grueling speaker's election that spanned more than 4 days and ended on a historic 15th ballot. The package passed 220 to 213. With one Republican joining all Democrats against it. Republican Representative Tony Gonzalez of Texas had publicly said ahead of the vote that he would not be voting for it. Republican Representative Dan Crenshaw of Texas did not vote. The 55-page proposal is the culmination of weeks of negotiations between newly elected Speaker Kevin McCarthy and a block of conservative lawmakers who withheld their support for his bid for the gavel until they were able to extract a series of concessions from the Republican leader. Those concessions have sparked concern from Democrats and even some Republicans and will significantly weaken Kevin McCarthy's leverage as Speaker. The new rules will also strengthen the position of members of the House Freedom Caucus. Fresh off a bruising speaker's election that spanned more than 4 days and ended on a historic 15th ballot, the House convened Monday evening to consider the package of rules governing its operations for the 118th Congress and laying out the new Republican majority's priorities. Representative Tony Gonzalez of Texas announced his opposition to the rules package ahead of the vote. A second representative, Nancy Mace of South Carolina, revealed on Sunday that she was on the fence about the proposal. In an interview with Face the Nation, Nancy Mace said she supported the rules package but took issue with the closed-door negotiations surrounding it that led the group of McCarthy's detractors to ultimately support his election or vote present. The South Carolina Republican also indicated that GOP lawmakers were not involved in the talks between McCarthy's leadership team and the conservative holdouts, have been left in the dark about what other promises he made. "We don't have any idea what promises were made or what gentlemen's handshakes were made. We just have no idea at this point," Nancy Mace said, "and it does give me quite a bit of heartburn." Democrats echoed that concern on the House floor on Monday. What I'm concerned about is not just what's written down here. I'm concerned by the backroom deals that Speaker McCarthy made with the Freedom Caucus in exchange for their votes, Democratic Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts said, mentioning Nancy Mace's comments. These rules are not a serious attempt at governing. They're essentially a ransom note to America from the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. The rules package at the heart of McCarthy's quest to become Speaker does include some of the concessions he made. Perhaps the most significant concession that Kevin McCarthy made in the rules package involves the motion to vacate the chair, a procedural tool used to remove the Speaker. The House rules under former Speaker Nancy Pelosi required a majority vote by a party caucus or conference in order for a motion to vacate to be brought up to a vote, and Kevin McCarthy initially lowered the threshold to force a vote down to 5 members. But in his effort to appease his conservative detractors, McCarthy eventually agreed to restore the ability of a single member from either party to force a vote to oust the Speaker of the House. The rules package calls for the House to take up a resolution establishing a select subcommittee on the weaponization of the U.S. federal government. The panel will be part of the House Judiciary Committee, which is expected to be led by Republican Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio. The British newsletter The Guardian has also covered the story. The Republican-led U.S. House of Representatives on Monday 9th of January adopted a package of internal rules that give right-wing hardliners more leverage over the chamber's newly elected Republican Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. Lawmakers voted 220 to 213 for the legislation, with only one Republican voting against. All 212 Democrats voted against the rules package, saying it was full of concessions to the right wing of the Republican Party. The rules package, which will govern House operations over the next 2 years, represented an early test of Kevin McCarthy's ability to keep his caucus together. After he suffered the humiliation of 14 failed ballots last week at the hands of 20 hardliners, before finally being elected Speaker on Saturday. The legislation includes key concessions that hardliners sought and Kevin McCarthy agreed to in his quest for the Speaker's gavel. The changes include allowing a single lawmaker to call for his removal at any time. Other changes would place new restrictions on federal spending, potentially limiting Kevin McCarthy's ability to negotiate government funding packages with President Joe Biden, whose fellow Democrats control the U.S. Senate. Democrats denounced the legislation as a rules package for MAGA extremists that would favor wealthy corporations over workers, undermine congressional ethics standards, and lead to further restrictions on abortion services. These rules are not a serious attempt at governing. They're essentially a ransom note to America from the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, Democratic Representative Jim McGovern said. Kevin McCarthy was hard at work on Capitol Hill on Monday prior to the House going into session, trying to head off any such revolt and ensure a smooth passage for the rules package later on that day. He can only afford to lose a handful of votes from his party in the House to avoid defeat on any measure. A clutch of establishment Republicans had indicated on Sunday they might withhold their support for the new rules package unless more details of Kevin McCarthy's concessions made to the right wing of the party are revealed, such as promising chairmanships of powerful committees that longer established and more moderate members have been eyeing. Pressure groups on Monday, 9th of January, stepped in to make clear there will be consequences if the first vote of McCarthy's speakership turns into a standoff. On Friday, hours before McCarthy formally was elected to the speakership, Texas Representative Tony Gonzalez said he would oppose the rules package, reportedly over McCarthy's willingness to cut spending to the Defense Department, the Pentagon. That prompted the conservative group Freedom Works on Monday to signal that Gonzalez should be frozen out if he rebels. The South Carolina moderate Republican Nancy Mace on Monday said she was on the fence. Speaking to CBS News on Sunday, Nancy Mace said, "On the fringe members who almost sank Kevin McCarthy's speakership bid last week," she said, "my question really is today what backroom deals did they try to cut and did they get those deals? We don't know what they got. We haven't seen it. We don't have any idea what gentlemen's handshakes were made. And it does give me a little bit of heartburn because that's not what we ran on." The package itself was published on Friday evening and includes a measure to allow a single member to force a motion to vacate the speakership, already weakening Kevin McCarthy's position. It also includes reinstating a provision to allow lawmakers to propose amendments to appropriations bills, adds a 72-hour window for members to read bills before they vote, and a commitment to vote on legislation on term limits for members of Congress.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Here at Hadith of the Day and IRIB English Radio, we would like to offer our congratulations to our esteemed listeners because, as you know, today marks the birthday of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Today on Hadith of the Day, we would like to recite for our esteemed listeners a beautiful hadith which has been narrated from Imam Zainul Abidin, his son, regarding one of the great virtues of Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein has numerous virtues. Some of them are particular and peculiar to him. This hadith is about one of the virtues which is common to all of the a'imma, and that refers to their generosity and their charity. A person named Shu'ayb ibn Abdul Rahman al-Khuza'i, a narrator of traditions, he says the following: a mark was seen on Hussein's back on the day of Taf. The day of Taf is a reference to the day of Ashura, the day when Imam Hussein was martyred. As you know, after Imam Hussein was martyred, his the enemies of Imam Hussein and his companions, they pillaged his body and the body of the martyrs. And, you know, they stole various articles of clothing, of jewelry, weapons from, you know, the martyrs. So perhaps this is a reference to the fact that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his blessed body, was left without a shirt, and some people saw markings on the back of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So they asked Imam Zainul Abidin about this. What are these markings that we see on his blessed back? Imam Sajjad alayhi salam said, "This is the mark left by the sacks of food that he carried on his back to the houses of widows, orphans, and the destitute." This is one of the virtues which is shared by all of the a'imma alayhi salam. You know, it's very famous that Imam Ali alayhi salam would carry sacks of food and groceries and other things for orphans and for widows. He would often also go into the houses of these people and actually, you know, feed these orphans himself. And a lot of times these people didn't even know who the person was who was bringing them these sacks of food. And only later on, when the Imam passed away, would it be disclosed for these people that it was indeed Imam Ali or Imam Hussein or Imam Hassan alayhi salam who was the one giving them this charity. And so this is a common in a sirat or a sunnat or a tradition which is common to all of them. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the virtues of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the words of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.